torpedoing the Free Speech Act is prosecuting the culture war. Bridget Phillipson, the rest of the Labour cabinet, they've drunk the woke Kool-Aid. This act would have made it more difficult to no-platform anti-woke speakers on campus, anti-woke students, gender-critical feminists, conservative intellectuals. They don't believe that those points of view deserve an airing on university campuses. And the best way to deal with them is just to suppress them. This is just the opening salvo in what will be effectively a war on free speech over the next 5 years.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Toby Young. Toby, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brendan.
It's good to have you on, especially given that free speech is back in the news. Free speech is an issue close to my heart, close to your heart as the founder and director of the Free Speech Union, of course. And there's a lot to talk about. And I want to kick off by asking you about what's happening in the UK right now under our new government, the new Labour government, which has taken action to block the commencement of the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act 2023. A very ominous start to this new regime. To kick off, I wonder if you could tell us what that act is about, how it came about, what is in it, and why we should be worried that it might not go through.
Well, the act came about because in the 2019 Conservative Manifesto, it said that if universities failed to address the free speech crisis on campus, the government would take steps to do so. And universities did fail to address the free speech crisis. And the crisis is real, as I'm sure I don't need to persuade you. And so the government brought forward this piece of legislation. The Free Speech Union were involved in originally drafting a kind of white paper suggesting what the government needed to do, along with about a dozen academics. That eventually became a bill. And then as the bill wended its way through the parliamentary sausage machine, it became quite watered down in various respects, and at some points, even more watered down than the final version that ended up on the statute books. But we pushed back and briefed various parliamentary allies, and we ended up with something which wasn't as robust as what we originally envisaged, but which nevertheless, I think, would have gone some way to protecting academic freedom and free speech on English university campuses. It's important to note it is just English universities it would have applied to, because education is a devolved area of administration. So what the Act does, or what it would have done, is it essentially incorporated the existing protections for free speech and academic freedom at universities in the Education Number 2 Act 1986, which aren't bad. The real difficulty is that for several decades, those legal obligations imposed on universities to uphold and promote free speech on campus were more honoured in the breach than the observance, because it was very hard to hold universities' feet to the fire. Universities, as I'm sure you know, all pay lip service to free speech. They all have free speech policies. They all claim to, up until now, be complying with their duties under the Education Act 1986, but very few actually did, partly because there are always going to be countervailing pressures on universities. The law in this area is very complex and gives universities lots of room for maneuver. And the upshot was that free speech was rarely prioritized by universities, contrary to their rhetorical claims. But what was great about this act isn't that it created more robust protections for academic freedom and free speech. It didn't really. It just incorporated the existing ones into the new law. The really innovative thing, and the reason it would have made a difference, is that it created these two enforcement mechanisms. So if you think that universities are not discharging their legal duty to uphold and promote free speech on campus, you could complain under this new law to the Office for Students. And the new act created the office of a kind of free speech czar filled by Arif Ahmed, a former philosophy don at Cambridge, who you could complain to. or you would have been able to complain to if you felt free speech, your free speech was being breached by a university in England. And it also created a new statutory tort, whereby if you were no platformed at the last minute, you could apply for an emergency injunction. And in addition, if you felt that the OFS wasn't taking your complaint seriously or dealing with it quickly enough, you could take a university to the county court. Prior to this, the only way of holding universities' feet to the fire would have been to judicially review a decision by a university, which is a cumbersome, time-consuming, and costly process. This would have been a much easier way to hold universities' feet to the fire and make sure they discharged their duties to protect academic freedom and free speech on campus. So it was a big shock when Bridget Phillipson decided not to commence the remaining and most important clauses of the Act.
As you say, I think that's a really good outline of what the Act is about. I've always thought the Act was generally a good idea, even though, as you say there, it's hardly the kind of gung-ho, robust defense of freedom of speech in all situations that some people like you and I would prefer to see. But it does, as you say, it has these enforcement mechanisms where if a university or a student union fails to uphold freedom of speech, they could potentially be fined. And if someone finds themselves being booted off a campus because they have supposedly controversial views, they can take action to try and get some redress for that. The fact that even those quite basic mechanisms that you would expect a modern day university to be quite agreeable to, the fact that even they are now potentially not going to go through under Bridget Phillipson, the new education secretary, is incredibly worrying. What do you think it tells us about this new government? If they have a problem with even something as straightforward as and presumably as uncontroversial as this, what do you think it tells us about their attitude to freedom of speech more broadly?
Bridget Phillipson's reasons for torpedoing the Act were, as I'm sure it won't surprise you, completely spurious. Let's deal with those reasons before getting to what we think the real reasons are and what the implications of that are for free speech more widely. So she said, first of all, that it would be burdensome and costly for universities to comply with the new regime introduced by the Act. That is nonsense. The DfE, the Department for Education, carried out an impact assessment in 2021, which estimated that the cost to English universities of complying with this new regime would be 4.7 million per year. And to put that in context, Brendan, in 2020-21, English universities, just English universities, spent £550 million on access and participation plans. So 4.7 million is a drop in the ocean. So the idea that it would have been burdensomely costly to comply with the new regime is for the birds. The second reason she gave, which I think some people took seriously, is that the new Act would have made it more difficult for universities to refuse to invite Holocaust deniers onto campus. And she presented this decision as a decision in part to protect our vulnerable and beleaguered Jewish community, Jewish students on campus. That's also bogus. The new Act didn't introduce any more robust protections than the protections which were already there. And those protections did not protect Holocaust denial. The free speech protections in the new Act are subordinate to the protections in the European Convention of Human Rights under Article 10, the right to freedom of expression. And the European Court of Human Rights has made it abundantly clear that Article 10 does not protect Holocaust denial. So that's why it's legal for Holocaust denial to be criminalized in some countries. Challenges to the criminalization of Holocaust denial have not been successfully made by appealing to Article 10 in the European Court. So it wouldn't, in fact, have made it any more likely that Holocaust deniers were invited onto campus. Now, you and I would like Holocaust deniers to be able to set out their stall on campuses, because then their ludicrous conspiracy theories can be rebutted. They can be publicly humiliated. And I think that's the best way to deal with Holocaust deniers. But that wasn't something that was going to be achieved by this Act. It wouldn't have changed anything when it came to the likelihood of Holocaust deniers being invited onto campus. It still would have been very easy to block any invitations along those lines. So that's also completely bogus. And it's worth noting, I think, that actually this act would have protected Jewish students and Jewish student societies. It would have made it harder for campus radicals to obstruct their efforts to arrange meetings, to have stalls at freshers' fairs, to invite pro-Israeli speakers. There was one clause in the act in particular, Brendan, which was precisely there because, and I know it was there for this reason, because the Free Speech Union lobbied the government to include it for this reason. Mark Regev, then the Israeli ambassador, was disinvited from City University in 2018, I think it was, on the grounds that the security costs of policing the event he was invited to would have been too high for the university to afford. Often a reason given for no platforming controversial speakers. It was given recently by Cardiff University as a reason for stopping a new group of a new freedom association formed by a group of academics from holding their first meeting. We managed to overcome that. But believe me, that's a frequent excuse used by universities, but it was used specifically and has been used several times to block pro-Israeli speakers on campus, not least the Israeli ambassador in 2018. And so there was a clause in the new act saying only in exceptional circumstances can university cite security costs as a reason not to invite contentious speakers onto campus. So various clauses in this act, and particularly that clause, would have protected Jewish students and Jewish societies. So the notion that Bridget Phillipson was torpedoing this act in order to protect Jewish students was just, that's also completely for the birds. So why did she do it? Well, I think in part it's because she was lobbied by the higher education sector, who were never very happy about this particular act. They regarded it as intrusive, also insulting, because it suggested that they weren't able to put their own house in order, and it required legislation to make them defend academic freedom and free speech. And the strong implication of the bill is that they weren't doing a good enough job. They weren't discharging their existing obligations and so forth. So it was insulting. It was unwelcome. They always hated it. They lobbied hard against it via their representatives in the House of Lords when it was going through Parliament. But in addition, and I think this is a really sinister dimension to this, Brendan, and hasn't had much airing yet, English universities are increasingly dependent on Chinese students. The government has made it more difficult for foreign students to bring their families with them, get visas for their families to accompany them when they get visas to study at English universities. So the number of foreign students at English universities is declining. So they're becoming increasingly dependent on Chinese students. So UCL, for instance, I think has just under 14,000 Chinese students currently on roll. Universities are under financial pressure because tuition fees haven't gone up since the coalition government. They're still £9,250 a year. They've been lobbying the government to put them up. The government doesn't want to put them up, and I don't think this government will put them up. So they're under financial pressure. They'll have said to Bridget Phillipson, if this act becomes law, if you don't torpedo this act, it's going to make it easier for people to object to Chinese propaganda on campus. It's going to make it easier for Chinese agents of the Communist Party in China on campus to no platform critics of the current regime in China. If you want the levels of Chinese students coming to English universities to remain the same, you have to get rid of this act. I'm sure that lobbying went on behind the scenes, and that's one of her reasons for doing it. But I think more broadly, Bridget Phillipson claimed that the act itself was an example of the Tories engaging in kind of petty culture wars, attacking Britain's great institutions for cheap point scoring purposes. But actually, torpedoing the act is an example of prosecuting the culture war. And I think that Bridget Phillipson, the rest of the Labour cabinet, Keir Starmer, they all sign up to radical progressive ideology. They've drunk the woke Kool-Aid. And this act would have made it more difficult to no platform anti-woke speakers on campus, anti-woke students, whether gender critical feminists, whether critics of the current regime in China, whether conservative intellectuals, and so forth. They don't believe that those points of view deserve an airing or should be discussed on university campuses. They think that those points of view are beyond the pale, and the best way to deal with them is just to suppress them. And I think that has grave implications in other areas of policy too. So I think it's likely that this government will introduce a Westminster equivalent of the Scottish Hate Crime Act. The Law Commission of England and Wales recommended, I think in 21, that the government introduce a Hate Crime and Public Order England and Wales bill, which was almost identical, although in some respects even worse than the Scottish Hate Crime Act. That's oven ready. I'm sure they'll present that again to Yvette Cooper, and this time they'll find a receptive audience. So I think that is heading towards us. I think Keir Starmer seems determined to criminalise Islamophobia in some way. So I think we'll have that to contend with. The appointment of Chris Bryant as a minister at DCMS, I think, is ominous, because Chris Bryant has been one of the leading parliamentary advocates for regulation of the press, which means forcing magazines and newspapers to bend the knee to a state-controlled press regulator. The Race Equality Act will further embed critical race theory in the workplace. The gains the Free Speech Union made in reining in the police in England and Wales over their recording of non-crime hate incidents, I think those gains will be reversed. Across a number of areas, I think free speech is going to be under assault. And this is just the opening salvo in what will be effectively a war on free speech over the next 5 years.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, get a discount on all items in our shop, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.
I'm very worried that you're exactly right when you say that. And I want to come back to the question of the culture war in a moment. All this denialism that they're involved in a culture war when very clearly they are. But I want to talk a little bit more about the situation at universities first, because you will know that one of the key arguments made by the higher education sector itself, and also by political actors and members of the media classes, they will say there is no free speech crisis on campus. It's an exaggeration. It's all made up by people like Toby Young and others who fantasize that people are being censored left, right and center. Now, we know that's not true. I myself was no platformed. We've seen numerous other people be no platformed. You mentioned gender critical feminists. They have been the latest targets of this form of censorship. Give us a sense of what the culture has been like on campuses over the past few years in terms of how stifling it has become. But also, I'd love to hear your views on why you think so many people just flat out deny that there is a clear problem in the 21st century university.
So the survey evidence that there's a problem is extensive. Ironically, the strongest evidence was provided by the UCU, the largest academic trade union, which has been implacably opposed to this act from the very beginning. And the head of the UCU welcomed Bridget Phillipson's decision to pause the act. But the UCU commissioned a survey in 2017 of the state of academic freedom at universities in Britain. And 35.5% of British academics admitted to self-censoring. And that's much higher than the EU average. I mean, we like to think that our universities are world-leading and great respecters of free speech and academic freedom. But actually, we were second from bottom, according to that particular metric, across Europe. This is when we were still in the EU, so across the EU. But there have been numerous other surveys since, carried out by Legatum, by Policy Exchange. all indicating that the levels of self-censorship, both by academics and students, is enormous. I think there was one finding in a policy exchange report which found that something like 4 out of 10 academics at British universities wouldn't sit opposite a gender-critical feminist in the university canteen for fear of the impact it would have on their reputation. I mean, really extraordinary. There's no doubt that there is a serious problem. The Free Speech Union, I mean, since we were set up in 2020, we've taken on over 2,400 cases, and about 20% of the cases we take on involve academics or students being persecuted for exercising their lawful right to free speech on campus. And, you know, I could give you countless examples, but one good example, I guess, is one of the first cases we took on, which is Selina Todd, professor of modern history at Oxford, who helped organize a feminist conference at Exeter College. This was in 2020, and the conference was to commemorate, it was the 50th anniversary of a kind of seminal feminist conference, which had taken place 50 years ago. And she was one of the organizers of this conference. And at the last minute, she was no-platformed by the hosts, because there were various trans activists on a particular panel who said they wouldn't participate if Selina Todd was involved in any way in the conference. So effectively, she was disinvited at the last minute from a conference she herself had helped to organize. And we complained to Exeter College and to the university, and they were quite apologetic and changed their protocols to make that less likely to happen in future. But that's just one example among thousands of people who've been no platformed because they happen to have unfashionable views, not unlawful views, but views which currently fall foul of radical progressive orthodoxy.
Anyone who's visited a campus over the past 10, 20 years will know that things are bad. Anyone who's spoken to a student or even some academics who have supposedly unwoke views or unfashionable views will know that the situation has become pretty dire. I was very interested to hear you earlier talk about the idea that Bridget Phillipson, in scrapping some of the key parts of this act, the idea that she is helping to protect Jewish students. The notion that the problem facing Jewish students in campuses in Britain today is too much free speech is a complete fantasy. The problem they face, in large part, is this kind of hysterical censorship, you know, the attempt to shut down Jewish events, the hysteria that greets any Jewish society's invitation of a representative of the Israeli state. You know, windows have been smashed, fire alarms have been set off. We've seen the most hysterical protests to try and prevent those events from happening. So clearly, the situation facing Jewish students today is one of a censorious persecution, not the idea that, you know, there's too much freedom and it might harm them. But that is a common argument, isn't it, of the modern day censor. They will often say that they are protecting minority groups. So they just want to protect Jewish students from the evils of Holocaust denial, or they want to protect black students from racism or trans students from transphobia. There has been this trend, hasn't there, to use minority groups as a shield to pursue censorship, which, as we know, always tends to benefit the powerful, not the powerless. The way in which modern day censorship is justified, especially in relation to the campus, is as an effort to protect the underdog, but it doesn't work like that, does it?
I've sort of been puzzling for a while over how seriously to take the arguments by the would-be censors that we need to no-platform certain speakers on campus, because allowing them to set foot on campus, just set foot, not even speak, makes various marginalized, vulnerable students feel traumatized and will have a negative impact on their performance in exams, their ability to engage with their teaching. It caricatures historically marginalized groups as being extraordinarily fragile, who require the protection of white saviors like Bridget Phillipson. I think it's a rhetorical smokescreen. It's just being used as an excuse to actually just shut down any people who pose any kind of challenge to woke orthodoxy on campus. They don't actually seriously care about the trauma or the psychological harm that inviting certain speakers on campus is going to cause to historically marginalized groups. If they did care, then they wouldn't be so enthusiastic about welcoming, as you say, hysterical anti-Israeli, pro-Palestinian speakers onto campus. They wouldn't create encampments. They wouldn't walk around with banners accusing Israel of genocide. They wouldn't chant from the river to the sea because, you know, even though I don't take seriously the argument that students of any stripe are so easily traumatized, they need to be protected from anything they find remotely disagreeable. If anything is likely to traumatize a marginalized group of students, then Jewish students are likely to be traumatized by pro-Palestinian encampments, you know, on their doorsteps. If they really did care, then they would go to much greater lengths to actually protect Jewish students. They don't care. It's just an excuse to no-platform people they disagree with.
If you think about the ideology of the safe space, it's presented to us, you know, the idea of the safe space is that universities should be zones in which people are free from transphobia and racist ideas and bigoted ideas. And as you and I know, all sorts of ideas, including perfectly legitimate ones, get bound up in those terms these days. So, for example, saying that a man cannot become a woman is now, in some people's minds, a poisonous form of bigotry and students should be kept safe from it. So they need to be ring-fenced against actual biological truth. One thing I've been thinking about the safe space ideology over the past 9 months since the 7th of October pogrom by Hamas in Israel, and then the more recent explosion of encampments on universities, not only in the UK, but also in the US, particularly at Columbia University in New York, it's really striking how some students are included in the safe space and others are not. So if you were to go onto a campus and say that trans woman is actually a man, you would be hounded off. You would be accused of hurting students' feelings. You would be accused of violating the ideology of the safe space. But we've seen students at Columbia, for example, refer to Israel as the pigs of the earth. We've seen open racist abuse aimed at Jewish students on US campuses. Some have been told to go back to Poland. Others have been told that Hamas is coming for them. It hasn't been quite so bad on the UK encampments, but there have been expressions of hostility towards the Jewish students, especially Jewish students who consider themselves Zionists. How do you explain that extraordinary double standard where some students are afforded the protections of political correctness and others are brazenly denied them? I guess that points to your argument that this is an ideological form of censorship that dresses itself up as protection of students.
Yes. I mean, I think to caveat what I said earlier, I don't think that when radical activists on campus say that if you invite Nigel Farage to speak at this free speech society, he's going to traumatize asylum seekers, children of immigrants at the university, etc. When they say that, I don't think they're conscious of just deploying a rhetorical argument in order to shut down someone whose politics they disagree with passionately. I think they may succeed in persuading themselves that they are actually protecting these vulnerable students. I mean, I don't think they like to think of themselves as censors. They don't think of it as censorship. They still claim to believe in free speech. And I think the reason they're able to reconcile that with being completely indifferent to the impact on Jewish students of inviting an Islamist hate preacher onto campus, it's cognitive dissonance, I think. It's not because they are conscious of being hypocritical. I think they believe that they're acting consistently. And one of the reasons I think they're able to maintain these double standards and this cognitive dissonance kind of thrives is because there's so little challenge. There are so few people on campus saying, hang on a minute, aren't you being a bit hypocritical? Isn't there a double standard here? Almost no one says that to them. So they're able to kind of preserve this cognitive dissonance. It's a bit like Brendan. I mean, I guess a parallel would be what recently happened in the Olympics opening ceremony with the pastiche of the Last Supper. The artistic director of the opening ceremony wanted to create an opening ceremony in which everyone felt represented, everyone felt included. And he used the French word for inclusion. And you kind of think, well, hang on a minute. Didn't it occur to you at any point that ridiculing the world's largest religion wouldn't make followers of that religion feel like they were included and represented in the Olympics opening ceremony? And you sort of think, well, was all this talk of inclusion and representation and tolerance and rights, was it all just a smokescreen for kind of shoving a rather narrow ideology down the throats of viewers? No, it probably wasn't. He probably thinks he is being inclusive, just overlooked the world's largest religion and the likely effect of including that pastiche of the Last Supper in the opening ceremony. Again, the same kind of cognitive dissonance is at work. That's how ideology works. You know, it infects people, and they imagine that in doing these brutal things, like destroying an act of parliament, which took 3 years to cobble together and involved an enormous amount of work involving hundreds of people and enjoyed cross-party support and essentially had reluctantly dragged the higher education sector, you know, along with it. Bridget Phillipson doesn't think of that as a kind of wanton act of vandalism or unparliamentary behavior or prosecuting the culture war herself. I think she's persuaded herself that this is a gentle and kind thing to do. And that's how ideology works. People are able to do the most brutal things by persuading themselves that they're being nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also really speaks to the double-speak nature of some of these terms. So particularly a term like inclusion, which you mentioned there, inclusion now basically means exclusion. Whenever I see the word inclusion, I think to myself, someone's being excluded. Because if you look at the way it's used on campuses, for example, people will often say, this is an inclusive environment, and therefore Nigel Farage can't speak, or therefore that supposedly Islamophobic critic of Islam can't speak. I mean, they use the term inclusion to justify exclusion. And of course, if you look at the way they talk about freedom from harm, they use the word freedom to justify what is often just censorship of speech that they consider harmful. And even the ideology of the safe space is actually quite unsafe if you're someone who holds apparently unacceptable views. And we've seen gender-critical women being bullied on campus. We've seen the critic of Islam, Mariam Namazi, being hounded and barracked and abused by big blokes because she has a particular view of Islam. You know, the safe space is not particularly safe for her, quite the opposite. And in relation to that double-speak nature of some of this discussion, I did want to ask you a bit more about the idea of the culture war, because we keep hearing Labour ministers saying the culture war is over, even as they are actually up in the ante in the culture war, as far as I can see. So Bridget Phillipson has said it in relation to universities. Lisa Nandy, the new culture secretary, has said it in relation to culture. And yet at the same time, these ministers are pursuing policies or promoting ideas which I think makes them culture warriors, whether they're destroying the last vestiges of freedom of speech on campus, or Lisa Nandy saying it's fine for men to take part in women's sports if they identify as women. How is it that they see everyone else as a culture warrior, whereas their own ideological zealous crusading is seen as perfectly normal and good?
Yeah. Again, I think it's tempting to conclude that they're just trolling us. You know, they're just kind of engaging in these naked acts of kind of culture war-like aggression and claiming that they are just following the evidence, to use Keir Starmer's words, unburdened by doctrine. But I think there's something probably slightly more complicated going on. I mean, one of the kind of puzzles of the kind of global elite is that technocratic managerialism has kind of become fused with radical progressive ideology. That's why Macron, whilst witnessing this kind of unbelievably woke opening ceremony, was able to tweet as watching, while he watched it, "This is France." You couldn't hope for a more perfect embodiment of technocratic managerialism than Macron. And yet he embraces radical progressive ideology. It's a kind of weird hybrid. I think what's going on when people like Keir Starmer say unburdened by doctrine is that they think that their radical progressive agenda kind of fits seamlessly with their technocratic managerialist approach, because they don't see it as contentious. they think that all those arguments have been settled. There is a kind of moral consensus about the need to defend LGBTQ plus rights, even in the most extreme form, that any opponents to, you know, the gender affirmative care approach are transphobes and bigots. They don't even consider the possibility that they might be opposing the medicalization of children who are confused about their gender. They don't even imagine that their opponents might be acting in good faith or in the interests of those children. Their view is that this isn't controversial, this isn't contentious, this is just the settled view of all right-thinking people. Anyone who disagrees with me is just a kind of hate-filled bigot who doesn't deserve to be taken seriously. So in a sense, you know, when they talk about advancing what we think of as their agenda in a culture war, they don't think of it as prosecuting the culture war. They just think of it as kind of doing something completely uncontentious that no right-thinking person could possibly disagree with. And they think of, you know, the net zero policy. They think of the response to the pandemic, all falling into the same category. It's as though their claim to authority rests not just on their technocratic expertise, on their extraordinary knowledge, their credentials, their access to specialized knowledge, and so on and so forth. It also rests on their superior moral expertise. What's going on there? I mean, I think it's sort of a response to the global ruling elite's kind of crisis of legitimacy. Their legitimacy used to rest solely, or at least to a much greater extent, on their claim to be experts. Their superior education, their credentials meant that they could help countries navigate various crises. But, you know, they did a very poor job of navigating the global credit crunch. They did a very poor job of stewarding the war on terror. Their response to the pandemic was kind of catastrophically awful. Crisis of legitimacy getting greater and greater. So how do they kind of shore up their power? Well, they say, in addition to our technocratic expertise, we're also morally superior beings. We're the only people that can be trusted to safeguard the interests of these historically marginalized groups and compensate them for their mistreatment in the past. And that's, I think, the kind of root of this fusion of technocratic managerialism and radical progressive ideology. It's almost as though, Brendan, when you watch something like Eurovision or the Olympics opening ceremony, you know, these are the most sacred values that are being advertised and promoted by the kind of European elite. This is clearly what they think their kind of legitimacy rests on, the fact that they are going to allow drag queens to perform in a pastiche of the Last Supper. And the fact that it was the Last Supper, which was the kind of ne plus ultra of the expression of these values, it's almost as though we're living in a kind of technocratic theocracy, you know, a kind of postmodern version of Iran. The claim to legitimacy by the ruling class, including Macron, but across Europe and also beyond, is that they are the upholders of these sacred moral values. And they're the only people that can be trusted to uphold these sacred moral values. And the reason we need to do whatever we can to see off the challenge by various populist insurgents is because they don't share these sacred values. We need to protect the integrity, not of democracy, but of this kind of postmodern secular theocracy. We're living in a bizarre moment. And it feels like, you know, if this is the best the kind of international global managerial class can do, if their authority rests on, you know, Papa Smurf dancing around in a tableau based on the Last Supper, then they're not much longer for this world.
Yes, technocratic theocracy, that's a very good way to describe it. It actually terrifies me that this section of society thinks that its beliefs are beyond discussion, beyond debate. And in relation to climate change, they will often say the science is settled. And in relation to other issues, they will often say the debate is over. You know, this notion that on these topics that are actually very contested and lots of people have questions about them, whether it's net zero, whether it's the trans crusade, whether it was the things that were done during the COVID pandemic in relation to lockdown and so on, these are actually contested issues and people would like to ask questions about them. But we live under a technocracy that sees these things as perfectly normal things to do. No discussion is necessary. Anyone who wants to discuss them must be a climate change denier or a transphobic bigot or a COVID denier. They hurl these terms of abuse out because they simply cannot believe that anyone would question their pure ideology, which they don't even think of as an ideology. They just think of it as common sense. In relation to the blasphemy that we saw at the opening ceremony in Paris, by the way, I'm fully in favor of the liberty of blasphemy. I wouldn't even want to ban drag queens doing a pastiche of the Last Supper, although I would ask why they did it at an opening ceremony watched by a billion people. That's a slightly different question. But you will know that while it is perfectly acceptable and actually quite boring these days to ridicule Christianity, it is unacceptable to ridicule Islam. And you mentioned earlier that you wouldn't be surprised if Keir Starmer tried to bring in a law outlawing Islamophobia in some fashion, and I think you're right about that. And as we've seen over the past few years, we don't really even need a law to make it incredibly hard for people in this country to raise perfectly legitimate questions about Islam. We've seen the Batley grammar school teacher who, as far as we know, is still in hiding because he showed an image of Muhammad in a class discussion on freedom of speech. The 14-year-old kid in Wakefield who was hounded for scuffing a copy of the Quran in the playground, and his mother was basically dragged into a public meeting and shamed before the audience for the blasphemies of her son. You will remember the case of the granddad in Dewsbury who lost his job at Asda because he posted a Billy Connolly skit on Facebook that made fun of Islam. There are numerous examples of people being punished quite harshly for daring to supposedly blaspheme against Islam. How has this culture in particular come about, where it is a risky business to criticize that one religion? And how much worse could that culture get under the Labour government, do you think?
Well, I think considerably worse. As you say, there are already informal Islamic blasphemy codes, which people get into enormous trouble for breaching. So to criminalize Islamophobia would really just be putting them on a kind of formal legal setting. But I think Keir Starmer does want to do that. And I think one of the reasons he wants to do that is partly, you know, just crude real politic. The Muslim radicals are organizing. We had the Muslim vote as a presence in the last general election. There are five independent MPs now sitting in the House of Commons who are essentially the MPs for Gaza rather than the constituencies they claim to represent. And it looks as though there's a kind of revolt percolating amongst fundamentalist Muslims across England. They're no longer happy just to be taken for granted by Labour. So they're making more and more demands of the Labour Party. And the Labour Party can't accede to all of those demands without, you know, alienating a lot of its other voters and the international community. But nevertheless, I think it can do this to placate that particular bloc. And I think it will. What's odd, Brendan, is that there is zero effort on the part of the kind of technocratic theocrats to accommodate Christianity. But they seem very keen to kind of shoehorn into their ideological kind of house of cards Islam, partly, I suppose, because, you know, they sacralize brown people because they're from a less developed part of the world and so on and so forth. They don't have this kind of colonial baggage, although they do, but it's not talked about. And that feels like kind of an operation which is doomed to fail, you know, trying to kind of reconcile Islamic fundamentalism with a hysterical enthusiasm for LGBTQ plus rights, you know, queers for Palestine. The cognitive dissonance required to mesh those two things together is so great that it's remarkable that it hasn't kind of resulted in more clashes than it has. But somehow, you know, the kind of dying international ruling class believes that it can extract some energy from this kind of vibrant global religion to kind of give it some force. I mean, you see it in Ireland. I mean, why do you think, you know, the technocratic, managerialist, radical, progressive elite in Ireland are so keen on, you know, radical Islamists in Ireland, given the tension that's causing? What is their agenda? What do they hope to gain from people with radically different values who are not going to assimilate and are just going to create problems, which we're already beginning to see.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now, on with the show.
That is the big question in Ireland right now. I think Ireland sums up a lot of the problems off the technocratic theocracy more broadly, as you describe it, in the sense that you have a governing class that is incredibly cut off from ordinary people. It doesn't only not understand them, but it doesn't care what they think. It thinks all their views are bigoted, and any questions these people raise about immigration levels or the placing of immigrants in certain small villages and towns, they must just, by definition, be racist complaints. They have no understanding that people might be concerned for the integrity of their communities or the traditions of their communities. It can only be racism that means that small villages in Galway or Limerick or Cork are raising questions about the sudden placement of a large number of people from faraway countries. And also, I think what you have in Ireland is an establishment that is much more interested in cozying up to globalist institutions than it is in speaking to its own people, far less representing what they want. It's a very new form of a governing class that feels much more warmth towards the European Union, of course, Davos, the United Nations, these institutions which expect you to have open borders, which expect you to invite people in and to override the old sovereign idea that a country should decide for itself who comes, why they come, where they should go, and so on. So I think Ireland sums up the rot of the new establishment in many ways, and its separation from its own citizens and its movement towards the ideology of a fairly distant globalist class, which has utter contempt for sovereign ideals, utter contempt for democracy, and utter contempt for ordinary people. So Ireland, I think, is probably where other European countries are going to go unless we put a stop to some of this stuff.
You'd think that the technocratic theocracy would be wiser than to risk alienating electorates. But they don't seem to be. It seems to be kind of very much part of their agenda, their moral agenda. I often sort of wonder about, well, you know, if they're genuinely concerned about the challenge posed by populist insurgent parties, why are they behaving like this? Well, you look at the censorship industrial complex. I think one powerful argument against censorship, against trying to suppress, you know, challenges to the technocratic theocracy, is that it's ineffective. It's going to have the opposite of its intended effect, like the efforts to suppress Nazism in the German Weimar Republic. And this was one of the arguments for the counter-speech doctrine, one of the reasons you're much better off trying to counter harmful or misleading or false speech in the public square with more and better speech rather than silencing those you find disagreeable, is that silencing them doesn't work. It doesn't kill off their ideas. It just gives them a kind of power that they otherwise wouldn't have. But that argument seems to be completely lost on the European Union in particular, past the Digital Services Act, now trying to force Twitter and other social media companies to suppress criticism of, you know, the theocracy. And you think, well, this is bound to backfire. This is just going to fuel the populist revolt. You know, people don't like being told that they're racist or xenophobic or small-minded or bigoted. You know, that's not the way to win the argument in the public square, just to kind of shut these people out and demonize them. You want to engage with them and say why you think, you know, they're going to benefit in the long term from mass immigration. But they don't. They just refuse to engage and try and suppress any criticism and demonize their critics. Doesn't work. Clearly doesn't work. Why are they doing it? Well, maybe the answer, Brendan, is that they don't care about the outcome of electoral contests because, you know, they're always going to be in charge, regardless of the outcome. You know, sort of like the aftermath of the EU referendum seemed like a tremendous populist victory, which was going to change everything at the time. And I was one of many people, you know, popping the champagne corks. But actually, it seems to have changed absolutely nothing, a hollow victory. And, you know, you can imagine these kind of populist insurgents win these electoral contests, enter the kind of chancelleries of Europe, rubbing their hands with glee, thinking now we're in charge. They pull the levers and nothing happens because the blob is in charge. And that doesn't change regardless. I mean, their cynicism about, you know, using suppression as a tactic, to me, suggests that they don't really care if it doesn't help them win elections. That's not what it's about.
I think that's right. The cultural elite, the woke elite, the shadow government, whatever we want to refer to it as, the Whitehall blob, I mean, they're always there. And they wield a growing amount of power that sometimes runs counter to what we vote into power. So yeah, there is that real problem of a kind of permanent layer of anti-democracy, which I think it really deserves our attention in the coming years. Toby, I wanted to ask you about the state of cancel culture at the moment. You've experienced cancel culture famously. We've talked about that before. Cancel culture is still around. People still face cancellation. We've seen many instances in recent years. I did want to ask you about the cancel culture that seems to be coming from the right of politics at the moment, particularly in the wake of the shooting of Donald Trump. There were numerous cases where people said stupid stuff online, or pretty outrageous stuff in some cases, where they said, oh, I wish the shooter hadn't missed. And Tenacious D, Jack Black's band, one of the members of that infamously said that his birthday wish was that next time the shooter doesn't miss. These people have faced cancellation, or they've self-censored themselves. Some people have lost their jobs as a consequence of things they said to two people on Facebook or whatever. I've had so many arguments with people over this issue, because my point is that cancel culture is always bad, regardless of who is enforcing it. You shouldn't destroy people's lives on the basis of something they said, even if what they said was dumb and even if it was immoral. You know, let's not destroy people's lives for their speech. And yet I've heard from other people, certain people on the right, saying, well, it's time they got a taste of their own medicine. You know, we've got to use their tools against them. That's the only way they'll learn. I don't buy that at all, but I'm very keen to hear what you think of that argument.
I don't buy that either. I think it's important to be more principled, less hypocritical than our opponents. We can't descend to their level and claim to be acting on principle when we oppose cancel culture. It's a harder road, but we ought, if possible, to try and maintain the moral high ground. And that ultimately, I think, is how we're going to win the argument, not by engaging in the same tactics as the other side.
Toby, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brendan.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.